Well, welcome back from the break. We're starting with the talks again here. And our first talk now will be by Dr. Ho Yamei, who is Deputy Head of Paleoanthropology at the Institute of Vertebrate Paleontology and Paleoanthropology in China. And she'll be talking about the earliest hominids of China. So, welcome.
Thank you. This afternoon, I'm going to introduce you some basic information, also some very new, very recent work of Chinese evidence about earliest hominids. This is the geographic map of China, and you see the west, southwest, especially southwest, very high, and the north in the east, and the north in the east plain, and here also some plateaus. There's plateau. And the main site I will introduce you in here Nihewan in the Hebei province, and Longgupo in the Chongqing city, and Renzidong in Anhui province, and Yuanmou in Yunnan province. So this is some important hominid sites in China. And the colorful marked sites are some early Homo erectus sites. Yuanmou is here, and Yunxian, Hexian, Tangshan, the same as Nanjing sometimes, called Nanjing, Lantian, Zhoukoudian. This is the position of Yunnan, and Yunnan is very famous for having many apes, like Yuanmou ape, Lufeng. Oh, I lost one picture here. And Kaiyuan. Oh, okay. Oh, here, okay. And by some research work, they say they have relationship with human or none of human. And this is Yuanmou Homo erectus, discovered by Tees, and this is artifacts of Yuanmou Homo erectus, quartz, and some retouched skyscraper and point. And the age of Yuanmou ancestors, different works. And the most recent work has been done by Dr. Zhu Rixiang, also together with Dr. Richard Potts. And they will keep the original old age, 1.7. And this is original picture of excavation of Yuanmou in 1960s, the upper two pictures. And this is the basin, Yuanmou Basin, and this is the section, upper part of the section. This is our survey there in the early time of this year. And here's some fossils of Peking Man. And this is Lantian Man in central China. And this is one date compared with Lers, also paleomagnetic, 1.15 million years. And this is a biface from Lantian Man site. Maybe this year, or I suppose next year, also a new dating for Lantian Man site, 1.5 or 1.7. This is Yunxian skull from Hubei province, in south, middle south China. And this is some artifacts, biface, or peaks. And there's another site in Hubei province, Jianshi. Here they found some piece of teeth, and Chinese researchers say they are humanoid. So these details of these teeth, artifacts also very small, and bone tools, artificial fractures. And here another site in the east of China, Nanjing, Tangshan Mine. And they show some affinities with Peking Man skull. And this is another cranium of Tangshan Man. So now I begin to introduce you some important Paleolithic sites, and some are quite old. Yuanmo Stele and Nihuan sites. Gongwangling, another name of Lantian, one name of Lantian. Yunxian, Longgupo, Renzidong, Bose, Yuanmo is here. So, south to the Three Gorges, Longgupo is located in a slope. It was a farmer's land and discovered in 1980s. And this is the earliest discovery of a drawer. And two artifacts. And this is from a secondary stage of excavation, and there are more stone artifacts. They use bipolar technique to split the pebble. And just in 2003, we begin a new excavation cooperated with a French team. It's a Sino-Franco team. And this is really a new work and also very significant. We clean the section, and you see, where's the light? No light. This light hole has been all excavated out by the old excavation. And no laser light. In 2003, we just worked. In fact, you see the yellow part of that short section, about 30 centimeters in 1 month. And so you can compare the working speed of our work from the old excavation. I think the excavation technique is really different, and the method also different. And it makes result very different. And the pink color is original square. Oh, no, sorry. We just divided original square into four new squares, and we excavated in the three parts. In the north, and mainly in the middle south here, and the west part. So this is the small area of our excavation, of our main area of excavation in 2003. And just down to the 20 centimeters, we found a layer of many bones together and artifacts. Almost 40 pieces of stone artifacts. These bones belongs to different species of herbivores, and most are limbs, part of the body. This is one artifact. Later I will show the detail. So you see the excavated area, the color square, and the section or the whole condition or the archaeological layer in the whole section. So we divided this section into different complex, and the complex two is our main work of this year, that year. This is compared with the original dating work made by a Canadian American, including Ross Chihan, in middle of 1990s, and the part of our excavation, our new excavation section. So the layer of C2-2A. And the artifacts from C2-2A. This is artifacts from C2-3 beta A. From C2-4 alpha A. This is the big flake and the small flake. C4-2A, small flakes and some with a few retouches. So by that time, we really found different layers, many layers of archaeology and artifacts, also very significant zooarchaeology layer. And another significant thing is the same layer we found artifacts and a tooth of gigant bisectors there from this layer. This is analysis by zooarchaeologist Christophe Grigaud for the layer C2-2A. Our team members for 2 years. Now I'm introducing another site, even older than Longgupo, in southeast China, called Renzidong. Sometimes they call Fanchang. This is a location, Yangtze River, south to Yangtze River. It is just along a rift in East China of Tanlu Rift. And this deposit of the site is like a Chinese writing human. So this is the name. Ren means human. This is the excavation condition directed by Dr. Jin Changzhu of my institute. Artifacts and mammalian bones. There are a lot of artifacts and different species of large mammals. And the artifacts is made from local raw materials and very unusual. This is some artificial fracture they found, and almost complete skull of Homo sapiens, elephant, and this is also strange condition of piling up elephant bones together. Different faunas and shows different types of fauna. And there are a lot of faunas from north. This is a primary paleomagnetic work. So it seems it happened an event of moving southward of animal. Now we go to South China, Bose site, Handex site. Worked with Smithsonian Institution since 1994. This site was discovered, in fact, in 1973. But the problem is the date. We have no any fauna remains because of the soil, acid soil. And fortunately, in 1993, it was my first year participating in this project, we found tektite. This is typical laterite deposit. You see the upper part and the gravel part of in the lower. And this is a section of one locality of Gaolingpo. This is excavation in one locality at Bogu. This is a big flake. This is the first discovered tektite. This one. And this is another year. We found again tektite. But here is only one piece. One small piece here. Oh, here. Here. 1.4 meters below surface. So, tektite is, you easily find tektites by exposure condition. And you see here, there's one, another one, the third one. So they seem at the same horizontal condition. This is an excavation in 2002 at Yangwu locality. We found a tektite layer. And we got 44 pieces of tektite. So it is really true that a tektite event, happening during a human Homo erectus period, I think, because just below we found the artifacts. This is a new excavation organized by Guangxi Local Natural Museum and my institute, also cooperated with Smithsonian Institution, Dr. Richard Potts. Just last year, we found some handex from lateral deposit and tektite there. This is just drawn by a reservoir construction. This is a part of original terrace. We were very exciting, and this is a co-leader of Dr. Wang Wei. So, by that slide, you see a handex from one locality. Oh, not this one, excuse me. These are from, oh, no, okay. These two from one locality, okay, Yangwu. And those are from other, because in the whole basin, we have almost more than 100, already known 100 localities. And these are from the same locality of handex. And you see fine retouched work by two sides. And this one, I think, maybe so far known the largest one of biface handex of the basin. This is work, long time work. And raw material. When we think about artifacts in Bose Basin, and we compare it with other places of the world, we have to think about the raw material and how much it influences the result or the final product. Now we go to the north, Nihewan Basin. This is the section, Lacustrine deposit, and the river, Sangan River, gets through the whole basin. And in this small area, there are a lot of lower Pleistocene site, including Majengo. This is the earliest discovery. After that, they found a lower layer of Majengo. This is the earliest, okay? This is Majengo third. They have artifacts, fauna, and even elephant print, a footprint. This is a core and flake. Now, Xiuchangliang site. The result has been published on Nature. small tools and a lake formation from this layer. Many small artifacts. Now the third one, relatively younger one, Donggutuo site. Here, in fact, here is an original trench, and this is a recent excavation trench. This is early 1991 excavation, cooperated with Indiana University, Nick Toth, and Desmond Clark, Cathy Sheik, Frank Brown, also member of them. And this is one layer of excavation, layer B, very dense artifacts with fragmentary bones. And the artifacts retouched very fine and different types, typology, skyscraper, ponds, buren, even buren, and scraper, notch, denticulate. This is buren. And different proportions of tools. Excuse me, in Chinese. And the most are sure, skyscraper. Denticulate also very many. Notch, and scraper, point, a borer, buren. And this is a new research work by my PhD. I named it Donggutuo core. This core was identified as a core producing small, long, elongated flakes. It means at this site, the early human, they didn't only need flake tools, normally flake tools, and they also need very small, longer flakes for some uses. And these cores just remind me some typology of typical Eastern Asia, not Eastern, North, and in the Korea and in Japan, the wedge-shaped core in the upper Paleolithic. Sure, they perhaps could not have very direct relationship, but anyway, it reminds me something to think about and to do more research work. This is Xu Jiayao site. From this site, we have discovery of Xu Jiayao Man in the same basin. And this is another site. It just shows it's not very earlier, but just show tradition in the near around place. This is adjacent province, Shanxi province, and the Sichuan culture. Many burins and many microblade from special core, special microblade core. This is a site in North China, a single site in China, with a character with typical Lualuar core. And perhaps it's the farthest site where the Lualua technique spread out to the east. And I found, when I was in Paris and looked through the old excavation storage, I found the core of Donggutuo core. And here, just go forward and not only talking about the early human, because there is a hypothesis proposed continuity and hybridization of human evolution, early human evolution in China. And here, there are some cultural circle. With some affinities to each other. And here is a place in Altai region of Russia. And I found They all have types, typology of Dongguk-do core. What does it mean? And in North China, the Nihoan Basin, from Lower Pleistocene, Middle Pleistocene, and to the Upper Pleistocene, the cultural layer is really visually continued. So this this is a hypothesis proposed by myself, and some thoughts, maybe not very correct, and needed to be checked. Just by the way, show you some landscape of other side. This is Salawusu in north, close to Shui Dongguo site. In north, very, very small. It's like, you know, like your nail. And this is to show you the section of layers, Chinese layers, and, you know, one layer of layers and one layer of paleosoil. So we have a good pool of layers dating work. This is a Zhenzidong site, one time Russian. She had visited there. And I think in China, we do have some evidence of human fossils and also seems more evidence of culture, early artifacts. And a better way is, I think, to work internationally and to make all problems open and have more clear questions to resolve problems we care about. It's already many researchers visiting and show interesting and begin to work. Either we say a multi-regional evolution model or a single origin model, I think China is important to think about and to have a position. And I think also perhaps not very very simple. I think in the south and in the north, out of Africa, or it could be a different way. And also inside China, it's still quite complicated and confused and maybe not very clear and often questioned or doubted by foreigners. So I hope you have questions and we discuss it and we resolve it together in the future. Thank you.
Okay. Well, our last speaker this afternoon will be Dr. Richard Potts, who is the head of the Human Origins Program at the Smithsonian Institution. And he'll be talking to us today about the evolution of human adaptability.
Thank you, James, and thanks to Richard and John Flegel and the host of co-organizers, and especially all the people who are the backup, who do the real work of getting us here and making us feel comfortable. We much appreciate that. I'd like to end our formal presentations today by broadening out, stepping back a little bit, and considering what we've heard today in the broad sweep of human evolutionary history. And in that regard, to focus on a really, I think, what we're talking about here when we're talking about the dispersal of humans out of Africa into other parts of the world, the breaking of whatever was involved with breaking the tethers of hominins in Africa, and allowing them to explore other parts of the world. And that's with regard to the matter of adaptability. And so I'd like to begin with a summary statement, and that is that we are really a very peculiar species. there is something extraordinary and something extraordinarily odd about us. We can sit in an auditorium all day listening to things that occurred hundreds of thousands of years ago. Some of us may be able to meditate for a few minutes or an hour or more, or watch, if you're a peculiar American, 9 hours of pro football on a Sunday afternoon and evening. Some among us can display extraordinary degrees of craftsmanship, feats of courage, artistry, the writing of music, mathematical formulas, novels. We're a species that apparently is capable of extraordinary acts of kindness and ability, and also extraordinary acts of arrogance and devastation that we impose upon others. We can speak of things that we cannot see, just as we're doing here today, about events that were long ago in the past, and we are a primate that may be able to plan to gather with a larger group than we have here today, but 100,000 of our own kind, of our own species, in a parade or a protest, or we can cram a few of us into a metal container that can make it to the moon. And to my mind, these are all expressions of an evolutionary history that has decoupled humans from a narrowing, constraining ancestral habitat, has broken the tethers that guided the ancestral lives of Miocene apes, Australopithecus, and perhaps even the earliest members of our own genus. And somehow, human beings today have become separated from certain ways of living that 2 million years ago were restricted to the African continent, and where the descendants, however, could expand on the possibilities of what an early human could become. And this process of breaking the bonds of ancestral possibilities is expressed, manifested, reflected in what I call adaptability. It's a quality that is certainly not restricted to human beings. It's almost certainly a general quality of all living things, that there has to be not only an ability to adapt to a specific type of environment, but also to persist when things change. And yet for a mammal, for a primate, adaptability appears to take on some astonishing qualities in our own species. We see adaptability in how humans survive unexpected change, how we alter our surroundings, our immediate surroundings, and when you become a worldwide, a global species, that means you transform the entire planet. And also we see adaptability in how we have come by our curiosity to explore new places and to create new adaptive possibilities. So the question I'd like to explore here is how far back in time that we see this in human ancestry, do we see the elements of adaptability? Related to this question is the overall shape and character of the human family tree. With the terrific pace of fossil discoveries over the past decade, some of which you've heard about here, it's become apparent that our own genealogy bears its share of diversity, like other groups of organisms, not a linear march through time, but a diversity of lineages in our branch of the tree of life. By about 6 million years ago, the lineages leading to ourselves and the closest living relatives of our species had divided. Genetic similarities and differences bear this out. And let's very briefly track the species, the fossil species that some people would recognize and identify as part of the unique genealogy of human beings. There will be differences of opinion in this audience about which names should be used and how those should be connected up. But it's just a general heuristic to make a point. Between 5 and 6 million years ago, the lineages, at least three lineages, are currently recognized at the base of our family tree. 4 to 5 million years ago, only one of those lineages continues, while perhaps with a different name, while another has its first appearance. 4 to 3 million years ago, the best known of which is this one, Australopithecus afarensis. 3 to 2 million years ago, the grand division of the tree of life into the large tooth forms and the larger brain forms of early human ancestors 2 to 1 million years ago, we meet the first species that were to spread beyond the African continent. And 1 million years ago to the present, the diversity continues with the Neanderthals, whose line became extinct apparently about 28,000 years ago. And Homo erectus continued for a while, and the origin of our own species. Well, we are, of course, one species now. The norm of human evolutionary history has been two or three separable lineages living at any one time, spread over, sometimes confined just to the African continent for most of this history, but after 2 million years ago, spread over some continents. Well, the point here is that along with this diversity has been a considerable amount of extinction. This is also a fundamental feature of our genealogy. And one thing that may help us understand why there has been such rampant diversity and extinction, or at least a fair degree of diversity and extinction, in the hominins may have to do with climate change, and this has been brought up in a couple of the slides in earlier presentations. But one thing that hasn't really been focused upon is that if you look at the grand sweep of Earth's history and its climate history, that humans evolved during one of the most dramatically changing eras in Earth's environmental history. This is very obviously reflected in the proxies, the measures that scientists have been able to figure out with regard to global or ocean climate change, such as with the great growth and the shrinking of glacial ice, captured by the study of stable isotopes, the comparison of two forms of oxygen, from long cores that are drilled from the ocean bottom. In this case, this is a combination of cores that that run for about 6 million years. And the up and down projections, as you may already have gathered, mark the heights of warm and moist periods, alternating with cold and dry climate. And these projections become more extreme as we go from the past and get closer to the present. A similar pattern, not the same, but a similar pattern of climatic instability also occurred in the tropics, not the ice ages, but alternating periods of strong monsoon and drought. These tend to occur on more of a 20,000-year cyclicity, periodicity. There is evidence then of not only the growth and intensity of the oscillation or the extreme of amplitudes, but also a series of alternating high variability and low variability intervals through time. So in all of these records of the past 6 million years, the evidence appears to be of greater and greater fluctuation over time. Well, in that light, there are, in a sense, three fates that we can consider here. And if we can see this as a general sort of climate trend or oscillation through time. And one of the possibilities, not the best one, is that you become extinct. And that is what this darker line is, the line in the middle here is representing, is the ability to follow habitat change. And here is an organism that's not doing a really great job of keeping track of these environmental fluctuations back and forth, and extinction may therefore set in. Many other organisms are capable of moving as environment changes. There is a great need for corridors of movement, not just patches of ground, but corridors of movement so that they can keep up with environmental changes. And yet this envelope around it stays the same. That is the amount of adaptability. That's one of the possibilities, is that you are able to move. But there's another possibility that's not necessarily totally decoupled from the move strategy, capable of moving in response to these environmental changes. But this envelope of adaptability is somehow able to broaden. And this widening of the envelope of adaptability, I think we would see as characteristic of our species' own evolutionary history, but not necessarily confined just to ourselves. And so, in this respect, the origin of our species is a remarkable survival story. The elements that define humans biologically and culturally emerged at different times over this long period of 6 million years plus, so that we see walking on two legs by at least 4 million years ago, emerged before making of simple stone tools that were used to obtain meat from large animals and to broaden the diet. These occurred before the first expansion of early humans beyond Africa. The significant enlargement of the brain, the control of fire, later followed by the origin of our own species about 200,000 years ago based on the fossil and genetic evidence, the development of more complex implements, and also the emergence of the blossoming of art and complex communication that indicate language in the modern human sense. It's not until 10,000 years ago that we see the oldest control and domestication of plants and animals on which agriculture depends. The fact that these features emerged in a world prone to dramatic environmental change suggests that adaptability to our surroundings and its uncertainties is a hallmark of our species and perhaps helps to set a context for the incremental change. It's not just a linear history, but the incremental change through time of the addition of human characteristics. In fact, I believe that a strong case can be made for the idea that the defining features of human beings evolved as a series of ongoing solutions to the problem of surviving in a world prone to uncertainty, a serious degree of change in the surroundings of local habitats, but also expressed by some of these regional and global measures of environmental change. And this, in a sense, is what I mean by adaptability. To define it more specifically, it involves the ability of an organism to endure environmental variability, to spread to new habitats, as we are certainly must have been the case with regard to the out of Africa one, the dispersal of hominins to Eurasia, and also, at least later on, the ability of an organism to respond in novel ways to its surroundings. And this may be even independent of environmental change, as we see with much of human history in more recent times. In the remainder of this talk, what I'd like to do is to introduce to you some lines of research involved with this topic that we have reported over the past 12 to 14 months that has been published in the journals Nature and Science and Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences. For the first example, we begin in Africa at the site of Hadar. This is obviously before the time period that we're talking about with the earliest dispersal of hominins out of Africa, but it's interesting to set some of the context for that. And this is the site of Hadar. My colleague, Raymond Bonfi, drew me into some of this research through her own fieldwork at Hadar. The Hadar site is well known for a particular fossil known as Lucy, Australopithecus afarensis, and a female skeleton dated to about 3.2 million years old. Hundreds of fossils of Lucy's species are currently known, spanning about a half a million years. And so much has been recovered that we're able to have not only this partial skeleton, but to reconstruct other elements that are missing from this particular find. And from this, we're able to see that Lucy, Australopithecus afarensis, was able to walk upright on two legs and had other distinctive human qualities, and yet Lucy's species also had long, powerful upper limbs, upper arms, useful perhaps, it looks like, from the biomechanical evidence, useful in climbing and living comfortably in the trees, and coupled a mosaic together that's not like any human that we would see today. Lucy's species also had a small brain. This shows a comparison of one of the male reconstructions to Homo erectus and also to Homo sapiens, about a threefold difference between afarensis and ourselves. And it's also apparent that Lucy's lineage lived prior to any evidence, any firm evidence at all, of stone tools, of stone technology. And so the researchers working with the Hadar project, particularly Raymond Bonfi, were very interested in trying to figure out what the environment of Lucy was like. This shows you a view of Hadar. The work at Hadar has been led by a scientific team from the Institute of Human Origins based at Arizona State University, working in association with the National Museum of Ethiopia. Raymond was the fossil pollen expert, and she was at the Smithsonian on a fellowship in 2003 and 2004, and that's how I became involved with the statistical analysis of her pollen results and the interpretation of them. And Raymond was able to acquire samples from many of these layers, and many of those samples had hundreds of grains of fossil pollen that represented the plants that existed at the time of each of those layers. From the pollen samples, she and her colleagues in France, and then later my own look at the data, were able to reconstruct the vegetation and climate and how these changed over time. And what we found were, at least to my eye, surprising results of how much environmental change was involved in the sediments in which we find the fossils of Australopithecus afarensis. Over the entire period between 3.4 and 2.9 million years ago, the habitat fluctuated between what we would reconstruct as one to an or another of these different kinds of vegetation types represented here. In fact, during the most forested time, we have evidence of a 20,000 year period, approximately 20,000 years, during which there was an increase in annual rainfall by about 14 inches, average annual rainfall by about 14 inches, and a drop in temperature of annual temperature by about 5 degrees centigrade. The intriguing thing, as I alluded to just a moment ago, regarding Lucy's lineage is that it survived or even thrived throughout. The fossils are quite abundant through this entire sequence of environmental changes in all of these layers, a period of roughly 500,000 years. We suspect that the adaptive options of this species, its versatility in moving around in environments and surroundings that had very few trees, as well as in times and places with many trees and also with very few trees, that enabled Lucy's species to adjust to these sizable swings in climate. And so as we return to this record of global climate change, not that this particular record is reflected exactly at Lucy's site, but as a general sort of record of ocean, from the ocean, global climate change, we see that afarensis flourishes during a certain degree of environmental change. This is the time period of that cooling and spread of forests at Hadar, seems to be registered in this record as well. But then what we see is that her lineage vanishes from the fossil record around 2.9 or 2.8 million years ago, just when climatic variation varied continuously at a higher level, both in this record as well as in the record of dust blown from the African continent into the deep sea. And so as we look upon these female and male reconstructions of her species done up by John Gerchy, Lucy displayed an unexpected degree of adaptability, at least unexpected to my eye when I first began working with Raymond, an unexpected degree of adaptability to widely changing surroundings, even with a small brain, and prior to any evidence whatsoever of even a simple stone technology. Early in this record, relatively early, although we must now see that this is midway through our understanding of our data on human evolution, we see this remarkable hallmark of versatility or adaptability, an ability to adapt to changing surroundings, but only up to a certain point before this species disappeared. For the second example, this will overlap with the information that Hoyame presented in some detail just now, and this is drawing from China. This is East Asia in general is the place with the second longest archive, relatively continuous archive of human ancestry after Africa. And specifically China, where I've had the terrific opportunity to and honor to co-direct several research projects in North China and South China over the past several years, including in South China with Hoyame, and in North China and to some degree in South China more recently with my my colleague, Professor Juri Shang. And what I'd like to do is to focus on this area in the northern part of this rectangle, and that's the Nihuan Basin of North China. It's located on the southern margin of the Mongolian Plateau, which you can see in the distance there. And our focus is specifically on the earliest humans to spread from Africa all the way across to East Asia, particularly in this case to Northeast Asia. And our questions include, when did this occur, and what survival challenges did those populations encounter? The early human who made this, shall we say, approximately 7,000-mile trek is represented here by the beautiful Turkana boy specimen from East Africa. But perhaps we'll learn more and about some of the variation in the populations that made this trek through new discoveries at Dimanisi and hopefully sometime soon in Indonesia and also in China. But the point here is that the body had changed significantly from Lucy's, much more closely resembling our own. This shows you the landscape of some of the sites where we have dug, and we have been sampling natural outcrops such as these, as well as, for deep pits. I show this slide not because it's particularly attractive, but just to show you that I don't always work in hot, dry environments, sometimes some pretty cold ones. But I want to draw attention to Professor Juri Shang, who invited me to co-direct some of these excavations and paleomagnetic studies with him, and Professor Xie, who carries out these excavations when Juri Shang and I are not there. But I also want to draw attention to the people who really do the work, the graduate students and the postdocs. They're the ones who scramble up and down these various hillsides and deep wells to collect the samples, and these samples are then studied in terms of the magnetic properties of the sediments, again assessing the paleomagnetic record and comparing them to the well-dated record of global shifts in the direction of the Earth's magnetic field. And what I want to do is that our work has, Doc say here, is that our work has focused in a paper that was published last September on a site called Majuanguo, which is Majuanguo 3, which is indicated here with tagged stone artifacts and many fossil bones of animals, dated to about through this paleomagnetic means and interpolating the rate of sedimentation in between the paleomagnetic events, dated to about 1.66 million years ago. The excavations have continued on down, which seem to indicate an age of about 1.68 for the oldest sites in Northeast Asia. And the sediments go down to about 2.6 million years ago, but there are no artifacts that have been found lower than about the 1.68 to nearly 1.7 million year time period. You can also see from the artifacts from Majuanguo the kind of flaking that's very typical of Oldowan type of flaking that occurred, that is well known, well documented in Eastern Africa. These look a little bit different, largely because the original form of the raw material are just broken chunks of rock. And so they look a little bit different from those stone tools made from river cobbles, say, in typical of African Oldowan stone tool assemblages. But the overall relationship of the flaking to the rock is Oldowan-like, is basically the Oldowan. You can also see that these stone tools and hammer stones were used for making cut marks and also percussion marks to get the bone marrow, the fatty bone marrow, out of these bones. And in a report that was in the New York Times that reported on this, our discovery, the reporter, I think, got it right when he said that there is apparently more of the Marco Polo than the Thomas Edison in these early humans, and that is they were more wanderers and explorers rather than innovators. We don't see much in the way of technological innovation, for example. I'll just very briefly point out a site that Hoyamei also mentioned, Yuen Mo, located here. We've just sent in a paper for review on this, and the dates that we're getting for Homo erectus teeth, incisor teeth, and stone tools is back to 1.71 million, which may represent, depending upon your point of view, one of the earliest, if not the earliest, combination of fossil humans and stone artifacts from the same layer in Eastern Asia. And so that leads then possibly to the oversimplified view that you basically go from say, Turkana up to Dimanisi and then over to a place like Uenmo and into Indonesia and up to the Nihawan. And yet I have a lot of these sort of dots along the way, but those are totally imaginary. And there are only really, on this particular slide, three data points represented by red points, and then we know that hominins were getting to Indonesia and also to the Nihawan Basin to the north. But there's a great need to study this, what I call the archaeology of passing through, something I think was driving these hominins very, very quickly through these areas, leaving hardly a signal at all of artifacts behind them. But once you get to places like the Nihawan, you find that the hominins stay there for about 600,000 years. Okay, they stay there for about 600,000 years and leave stone artifacts in concentrations in many different stratigraphic layers, and they disappear right around the time when the monsoon conditions in Eastern Asia become intensified. Okay, and so they're there during low amplitude climate change, but then when the amplitude of climate change increases, they're gone for about, it looks like, a couple hundred or 300,000 years, and then they come back in with Peking Man and other sites later on. And so this is kind of a pattern that we see similar to what we saw with Lucy. The populations are around for a certain degree of environmental change, but then they're gone when the conditions ratchet up to a higher range of variability. So for the last example, the final example, I'd like to go back to Africa, to the Rift Valley of southern Kenya. And this is a view of the southern Kenya Rift and a satellite view of the southern Kenya Rift and to the Olorgesailie Basin, which is there inside the rectangle. And you can see even from here the white layers that represent the diatomites, layers of the diatomites of an ancient lake that existed as a dominant feature in this region for much of the past 1.2 million years. The diatomites are seen here closer up, but there's really what you find, a beautiful sequence of environmental change registered in the Olorgesailie Basin, a basin about 300 square kilometers, where you see the lake diatomites and river sediments and soils when the landscape stabilized, tephra deposits of ash and pumice that allow us to date these sites. The renowned feature of this area where we've conducted research with the National Museums of Kenya over the past two decades is the abundance of stone hand axes and other stone tools. And nearly every single object that you see here, an area that was discovered by Mary and Louis Leakey in 1942, almost every single object you see there is a stone hand axe. And that's basically what they look like, chipped all the way around into roughly an oval shape. The making of hand axes was the longest-lived ancient technology that we know of the Pleistocene. It was the dominant type of tool making for more than 1 million years, which is really, when you think of it, an inconceivable amount of time for something to stay stable in human technology. A couple of years ago, our work led us to dig here along this ridge that has been covered by sediment, a ridge leading up to Mount Olorgesailie that you can see in the distance. And there we made this discovery that Susan and Anton referred to, this very small but adult or near adult hominin fossil from Olorgesailie. It's dated to 900,000 years old. We found the brow ridge and the left ear region of the cranium and nine other cranial fragments of it. As I mentioned, it's very small, and yet it shows features typical of this wide envelope of morphological, of appearance variation that we're beginning to understand about Homo erectus and Homo erectus-like hominins, however you might divide them up, or keep them as a single hominin species. The significance of this find, it's the only really clearly dated fossil in Africa, or especially in eastern Africa, from a prolonged gap, a 400,000-year gap in the human fossil record of Africa. We also finally have a glimpse of the hominin. Wish we had the face, but we don't. But a glimpse of the hominin that was the maker of those hand axes of East Africa. The hominin comes from the exact same level from where those very dense concentrations of hand axes occur in at Alorgisaili. And third, getting back to the topic here, is that in this fossil human, we have yet another chapter in the story of adaptability. And so in brief, the record of environmental change at Alorgisaili is extensive in that hillside. That slide I just previously showed you, you can walk up that hillside and you can see times when the lake was present and broad and times when the lake was completely gone and had contracted to a dry evaporite deposit, and times when there were soils and then the lake comes back with a vengeance. And you can just track these changes through time, not only up hillsides but across the entire basin. And what we see is that the animal, the fauna, the focusing on the large mammals from Alorgisaili, that whenever one of these major changes occur that affects the entire basin, the entire hydrology of the basin and the adaptive conditions there, is that the fauna changes quite a bit. That you can go from a time, say 990,000 years ago, when equids, the zebras, were the dominant fauna, to a time when Therapithecus was the dominant fauna, to a time when the hippos and pigs were the dominant fauna. And so there seems to be this this assembly of faunas, and then they have to leave, of mammalian species, and then they have to leave the area because of these dramatic changes, and they reassemble, and they come together in different combinations. But the hand axe makers keep pushing on. They're there in all of these layers. And in this composite geological section, what I've done here is put these arrows, these many arrows, where registered these basin-wide environmental changes due to climate, but also due to major volcanic eruptions. And the red dots indicate the times where we see hand axes, and that these hand axe makers are able to persist through this whole period of environmental change. And so the point that is then reflected here, going back for a last time to this particular diagram of global climate change, is that hand axe technology flourishes during this period of when environmental change, at least registered in this global record, has ratcheted up. But it basically then peters out right around the time when, what do you see? You see it ratchets up even further, that the range, the amplitudinal range, is increased. And so the hand axe maker, we think, was apparently, or the hand axe itself was apparently an implement that was enabled our immediate forebears to adapt to a wide range, a wide variety of environmental circumstances, but again, only up to a point. And so then those are three examples of how this research is proceeding on what I might call this unsung aspect of human evolution, namely adaptability, how it's investigated, how it's pursued by research teams in East Africa and in East Asia. Three examples being the surprising adaptability of Lucy's species, the oldest dispersal of human ancestors into East Asia and especially into Northeast Asia, and also the adaptability that we see registered back in Africa after a million years ago by perhaps an immediate predecessor, certainly an immediate predecessor, whether it's an ancestor or not, it's unclear, that foreshadowed the adaptability, the remarkable adaptability in our own species. What I'd like to do is just end with one of my favorite pairs of slides. And I've come to think of human origins as an immense journey, as it's been called, beginning here in a predicament, perhaps something like this, and in a sense ending up here. This is the epic story of humankind becoming adaptable, laid the foundation for our ability not only to survive, but ultimately to imagine, to explore, and to learn new things about the world around us. And this is part of the human legacy that I think we're beginning to find out has deep roots in our evolutionary past. Thanks very much.
Oh, thank you, Rick. Okay, we'll now move on with our scheduled panel discussion. So at this time, I'd like to invite our panelists to come up to the stage, and I suppose the other staircase is the easiest way to do that, and have a seat behind where your name is. And just as we did this morning, we'll start by having each panelist briefly introduce themselves, and then we'll have them discuss things among themselves for a bit, and shortly we'll open it up to questions from the audience. So, okay, so do you want to start at this end, just a brief introduction of yourselves and move down the line?
My name is Parth Chauhan, and I'm a postdoc researcher at the Stone Age Institute in Indiana.
My name is Russell Chauhan. I'm a paleoanthropologist from the University of Iowa.
I'm Robin Dennell. I'm from Sheffield University on the other side of the pond, and I'm primarily an archaeologist.
I'm Rajiv Patnaik from Punjab University, India.
I'm Michael Petraglia. I'm from the University of Cambridge.
I'm Philip Reitmeier from upstate New York, Binghamton.
I'm Yari Zaim from Laboratory of Paleontology, Department of Geology, ITB Bandung, Indonesia.
Thank you. All right. Well, obviously, our panelists all have their own views on the subjects that we've been hearing about this afternoon and indeed this morning. So, would any of you like to start with some brief comments?
Yeah, I'd like to start. I'd like to address the issue of when humans first got to Asia. Obviously, this is one of the central topics of this whole Out of Africa One symposium. My personal connection with this is the field site I work at, and that's in the Sangaran Dome in Indonesia. You heard about this earlier today from Susan Anton and from others. I work there with Yadi Zaim, who will be talking a bit about the geology a little later on of that site and of Java in particular. I think one of the interesting things that have come down today is we're trying to really refine the dates of when humans got there. If we look at specific evidence from the Sangaran Dome in the area of the Bapong Formation and where the earliest Hams occur, right down into the upper part of the Sangaran Formation, we can bracket very well when humans got there. We have recently found new hominids in the level that actually lies below a pumice level dated at 1.51 million years ago. We have other dates of 1.55 at that same level. And then we know that hominins are in the underlying Sangaran formation, the very upper reaches of it. We have no date from that yet, but I suspect it's around 1.6. Now, if you think about those dates there that are relatively new and are connected specifically with Hams in that area, we can now look up in the Neowon, where Rick Potts just talked about. We have dates there of going back to 1.68, and also possibly in Yuan Mo, the redating of it is around between 1.6 and 1.7. Now, this is the range of dates that we actually know, speaking with what, you know, addressing the issue that Richard said, what is the real evidence for the earliest dates? We've heard the date in the morning session of 1.8. Of course, that's a date that relates to the Dimanisi site. It's a date that's heard a lot. But the issue is, are any hominins in Asia 1.8? And of course, the famous site that kicked this all off was the site of Perning or Mojokerto. And that site is in the process of being redated. And I'd like to ask Frank Huffman, who's out there somewhere. Frank? Okay, can you give the mic to Frank? And I want him to say something about that, then I want to finish my comment. Because I think this really addresses the issue of when humans reached Asia.
You want me to say that I've been working with Yadi Zaim on the Perning site for the last several years, and we're in the process of doing a number of things there. There's a paper that should be out in the Journal of Human Evolution early next year that talks about the relocation of the site. This is a fossil that was found in 1936, as Susan Anton said. And there has been some confusion over exactly where the site was. I think we have a really good case of knowing exactly where it is. And we find it to be about 20 meters stratigraphically above the layer that was dated in 1994, or published on in 1994, from that area. On that basis, and the work that we're doing on the actual geochronology of this site, I'm quite convinced that the fossil is considerably younger than 1.8 million years.
Okay. So my point is, I think we really now, that was the 1.8 date. It looks as if that the Perning skull actually lies quite a bit above that, and therefore it likely is younger. In fact, Frank will soon be publishing exactly how old it is. And but my point about this is, I think we need to be thinking about dates of 1.65 or 1.6 to 1.7. This is the real datum, and we can actually say, I think Rick Potts's point about the Neowon, that when you go below that one level, you get back to 1.68. Below that, there are no artifacts. And so maybe we can really zero in on exactly when that is. And that's interesting if you think about the Dmanisi dates and when humans were moving out to that site, especially Eric Delson's comment earlier, 20,000 years to move across the continent. Maybe it could have been that fast. The whole point is maybe we really need to be addressing the issue of humans reaching Asia at somewhere between 1.65 and 1.7. Okay, that's my comment.
I'd follow that up from a different perspective and I think a different set of conclusions. The first point I would make is that I think we need to acknowledge our ignorance and uncertainty about Asia and keep our options open, especially in the light of discoveries in the last few years. One point I always make to my students at the start of undergrad lectures about Asia is just to remind them that the distance from that wonderful Acheulean site of Boxgrove in southern England to Sterkfontein in South Africa is around 5,300 miles. And we now have this wonderful transect of the whole East African Rift Valley and much of continental Europe sampling early hominids over that distance. It is the same distance as from Ubudea to Sangiran, for which we have only two points of observation at the eastern and western end. My view is, though, I think our knowledge of early Pleistocene Asia in the year 2005 is roughly the same as our knowledge of Africa in 1960 at the point when the East African sequence began to be understood with the discovery of Homo habilis. I'd remind us also that even in East Africa, which we know pretty well now in the last 45 years, there have been seven new taxa in the last 10 years, and only in the last month, the first fossil chimpanzee. So I do think we need to bear in mind that with Asia, we have a very large area of which we know very little indeed. So my point would be, following up from what we saw about Dmanisi, and my question is to my colleagues and to you in some ways, is if a little hominin with a small brain and a very simple stone technology could get up to the Caucasus Mountains by 1.8 million years ago, what on earth was stopping a small-brain hominin with an equally simple technology doing the same any time after 2.6 million years ago? So rather than attach importance to the few, very few dates we know which are reliable from Asia, I think we need to consider a wider range of possibilities.
Yeah. I will add to Russell Chauhan. That's very interesting to understand about Sangira in terms of geology. We have reconstruct about sedimentation during the deposition of Pabang Formation, which is rich with hominid fossils. we can reconstruct at least five cycles of sedimentation, and almost of them that contains of vertebrates and hominids. That, and also it's very interesting, you know, that almost 200 specimens of hominids from Indonesia is found from Java, and most of them from Sangiran. So it's mean Java is like a home for the hominid in Southeast Asia during Quaternary. This is very interesting. Although we found also Floresiensis, but it's just in the eastern of Indonesia. But most of them are from Java. So it's Java man. I came from Java, so I'm Java man.
I'd just like to sort of back up what Robin actually said. I mean, I have no problem with these dates of 1.8 million years ago of hominins getting out of Africa. But we are looking at very, very limited information. We've heard talks about, you know, dates in the Levant and in Georgia, and then we've heard about dates in Java and China. But imagine the world out there in between those points. You've seen a lot of arrows from the Levant all the way over down into Indonesia, and Rick had, you know, all those dots across his map. But that is a huge geographic area that we know very little about. I mean, there's a lot of archaeology, but what we don't have are the dates. So what we really need in the future, and Richard Leakey asked us this morning, you know, what do we know and what do we want to know? Well, we want to know a lot, and I have a feeling there are going to be very many surprises as we undertake new research in Arabia, the Iranian Plateau, the Indian subcontinent, in Southeast Asia. Could you imagine if the amount of work that's been done in Africa was done in that big geographic area, how much more we would actually really know about dispersals and how they actually occurred?
I take from Mike the point that there is a huge gap. And my concern is whether the environment was conducive enough to support early man there. And when we look at the shivaliks, the early Pleistocene deposits, there is an upsurge in tectonic activity all along the Himalayan foothills at around 1.75. So that was the time when there was a lot of upliftment taking place, and you have a lot of boulders coming in, and at least the raw material was there. And as far as the supporting or the associated faunal material is concerned, we have Theropithecus, we have Meganterion, we have Crocuta, and others that are very good for correlation. And we can always go for more paleoanthropological studies and do more field works.
Sure.
What everyone else is saying, like Mike was saying, Mike Petraglia, that a lot of areas have not been a lot of the areas have not been really surveyed well enough, and we need to focus on those areas and actually think about which localities and which exposures we can focus on and implement projects, you know, international multidisciplinary projects. And another thing to think about is not just the lack of surveys, but the lack of evidence where surveys haven't conducted. For example, the famous Movius line and the dichotomy between mode one and mode two tools is still, you know, very ambiguous, and we don't know the answers to those questions. So, for example, in India, where I work, one reason to explain such just missing evidence, because India is situated between the earliest sites to the west, like Dominici and East Africa, and the earliest sites to the east, which is Java. It kind of makes logical sense that early hominids were passing through this area, but we don't find any evidence. And whatever evidence we do have is scanty at the moment. For example, the Pubby Hills material and the Rewat material, which Robin Dennell has worked on, so far we only have one site. So we need more evidence, but We should also appreciate the lack of evidence, actually the reasons for the lack of evidence, because, for example, in peninsular India, we have very little late Pliocene and early Pleistocene sediments to begin with. So even if hominids were settling there, many of these sites are probably not preserved as well as we would like them to be. So.
Yeah, Dr. Reitmeier?
On the same vein, we've talked a lot today about dispersals, and we've framed the question in terms of dispersal from Africa into other regions of the old world. People have raised a question about what routes may have been followed, and we've just now been talking about dates. But if you look carefully at the dates, I wonder if we should... Am I doing this? I'll try not to move. I wonder, as we look at the dates, whether we mightn't be cautious about reading too much into them. We're talking about 1.75 to 1.8 million years as a datum for Homo erectus in Africa, 1.77 as an appropriate age for the hominins at Dmanisi, 1.6 people seem to agree to in Java, if not before, and perhaps now on recent evidence as early as 1.7 for China, certainly 1.65 for northern China. I wonder if all of those readings are statistically distinguishable from one another. I wonder if maybe we should raise an old question which concerns the direction in which people were moving. It's a big issue, and we can't deal with it this afternoon, but perhaps it will come up again over the next few days. Richard Leakey said earlier this morning that he thought that some of the questions paleoanthropologists ask and some of the arguments that we raise keep coming round over and over. There's a certain circularity in the field. I think that's right, and I think to some extent it's healthy. We ought to revisit these issues as we have fresh information. So here's a chance perhaps to talk about whether dispersal from Africa was one way or whether there were movements back again from Eurasia into Africa at some point.
Well, why don't we open things up to the audience and see if there are any questions out there.
Of course, relative dates are a lot more interesting than absolute dates. And one relative date has been pointed out numerous times is already settled. That is, there are tool users in Africa long before they're in Eurasia. I don't think that's in dispute, yeah? So the other interesting relative date is, are any other non-hominin African species coming out into Eurasia long before hominids? Do we have any basis to assume one way or the other about that relative date?
You have stumped the panel. Any thoughts?
Should have asked it this morning.
Yeah.
So somebody mentioned...
Well, you've got Africanists here.
Yeah,
John Shea was mentioning this morning the hippo site without any hominid fossils or stone tools, and that was some evidence of pre-hominid dispersal.
Yeah, I think most of the morning researchers, most of the folks who spoke this morning were trying to link Homo erectus and these various non-hominid groups leaving at the same time. So I think your question is, what is there evidence that something moved earlier? Well, probably is, but would anybody like to address it? Yes, go ahead.
Hi. I'll just go back and maybe say what I said this morning again for clarity. I think the fact that we have two species of hippos in Ubudia, one is Gorgops, which is classical East African taxa that appears only in Ubudia, let's say at 1.45, which we'll say came out with a Homo, that's fine. But if we have an endemic species of Hippopotamus behemoth, that had to have come out before, and we have to give it enough time to have evolved. Now, how long would that have been, I don't know. But it couldn't have been too short of a time, because we need to give some time. And so was it 1.8, and then we just don't have the hominids? The hominids came out in Alek al-Akhmar. I'm not sure. I think 300,000 is a little too short. So I would give it slightly before. And I just mention, I know it's considered maybe a non-site, but we have the 2.4 in Yir'on that was published by Avraham Ronen. Questionable as far as the lithics and the dating, but still around, so in our region, so that also should be considered. And we have the lithics in Nachal Tzichol, which is down in the Arava, and that hasn't been dated, but the lithics look just like Ubadiyah. And we have a whole series of sediments that can be attributed to freshwater lakes all through, from basically all the rift all the way up to Ubadiyah. So we're talking about dispersals of hippos. We could probably correlate them via the Nile corridor up to Ubadiyah. So maybe that would answer your question, partially at least.
And another partial answer might be that, going back, I've just recalled Elizabeth Rivers' articles of 1995 with her climatic model, indicated two-way traffic between Asia and Africa, with I think almost as many types leaving as coming in. The problem is still one of calibration and dating, because the Southwest Asian faunas are scarcely known, apart from the Levant, and those of India, the next point of call, are still very poorly calibrated.
Anyone here?
Talking about the dispersal of Homo erectus into Eurasia, and as I think, Europe is part of Eurasia, yes or not? And, well, you are talking about only about Asia, about the findings in Asia, about the these lithic artifacts in China, 1.6. But I want to say that in Europe, there are several sites older than 1 million years that had to be now, especially the sites from Morce in the southeast of the Iberian Peninsula, where we had found several sites, Fuente Nueva and Barranco León. The age is around 1.3 million years old, and we have at the moment more than 2,000 lithic artifacts in both sites. These are in connection with early Pleistocene fauna. This fauna is close to the fauna that is found in the Caucasian region. Also, there are some species of Asian origin that now we are trying to determine. But in the last seasons in the Orce area, we have found some in small pieces that could be 1.5, 1.6 million years old. I want to see that to say that we are in the 37 parallel in the south of Spain. The Manisi is in the 42 parallel, and the Nihoan Basin is more or less in the same parallel. We are in the middle latitudes, and we cannot discard the possibility to go into the west, as you are. You think hominids are only going into the east. And when you are in the middle latitudes, you can go everywhere, because the climatology is more or less the same in Spain than in China. Thanks.
Richard?
I just want to put, I'm not sure it's a question, but make the point that the structure of this symposium was conceived with a view to preparing the ground for the next one. And I think there's a fundamental issue that the series of symposia are looking to solve. And in terms of this one and the next one, what we're really looking at is something that Fred Spohr touched on this morning, and he very easily mentioned two species of Homo that coexisted between 2 million and 1.5. And I want to say, well, we're not there yet. But clearly, there is increasing evidence that at some point around 1.7, 1.8, and it doesn't really matter specifically, something happened that enabled an early example of Homo to go beyond Africa. I don't think anyone's in any doubt about that. It's extremely important when looking at the Eurasian story to see if we can tease down when it was and then refer that back to Africa and see what was going on in Africa, that where there's a much more complete record going back, that will enable us to see not just what the anatomy is doing, but also what the environment, some of the adaptive responses to those changes. We're trying to take this to a point where we understand why, what it was. And we can't do that until we pick pick a point. And I think we've got to be very careful we don't get too chauvinist about which date's older than the other and for what reason. It doesn't really matter. What we want to know is, when does the story begin out of Africa, and what was going on in Africa at that time that will enable us to understand what may have driven that beginning of that story. I just want to make that point in terms of referring the panel back to what we're really trying to do here with this series of symposia.
Well, I think that it's important to make those calibrations in Asia, which I think we're able to do now. If you look at the state of research in Asia 10 or 15 years ago, we didn't have this kind of control over the dates that we have now. And granted, as Robin said, we don't know that there couldn't have been something else happening earlier, and we have to keep that option open. But I think I see the next 5 years or so, or 10, allowing us to further zone in on the exact calibration points of when humans get to Asia. And then we'll be further along. I wanted to make one other comment about Dimanisi, too, that I think is interesting. And this reflects, this issue of Afrocentric views of things. I mean, if you think about it, Dimanisi already has an extraordinary record of Homo erectus. Given the pace of discoveries that are being made there, in a decade, it may outpace our understanding of Homo erectus in Asia or Africa. And in a sense, our main comparative sample for Homo erectus might be Dimanisi. And that's, again, something that no one would have ever suspected, given what we know. And I think I really applaud the work that's going on there, and I'm happy that things are being published relatively quickly as well, and or at least put out for view, just like David's talk today. It's good for all of us.
Could I follow that up with a morality story? Or is it not a morality story? It's a story with a moral. And what triggered this little recollection is, we've heard various statements about the absence of artifacts below a certain horizon indicates the absence of hominins. All I'm going to say is that the best researched area in the world for the Paleolithic, the area which has been investigated longest by the largest number of people, is southern England. It's where Paleolithic archaeology started in 1797 with the discovery of the first hand axe. For the last 20 years, it's been more or less understood that the one reliable datum line in Europe is that hominins did not get to England before 500,000 years ago. We have a string of sites, the first of which was dug in the 1850s, so it's a well-researched area. In the last 2 years, we've discovered that there's another 150,000 years in East Anglia that was unsuspected of human occupation. So I just mentioned that even in the best researched area in the world, we cannot take absence of evidence as evidence of absence for granted.
Yes. Eric?
I was going to comment a little bit on exactly what Robin just said, but from the other point of view. There are many older European faunas in the Pliocene, none of which have been associated with artifacts. So it seems that up to 2 or a little younger than 2 million, we can say pretty clearly that there are no artifacts or no other sign of of human occupation in the European subcontinent. It's clear that absence doesn't prove anything, but it's also clear that we need evidence in order to make a case. And we can hypothesize all we wish, but until something is found, it's no good. The dates in the Guadix-Baza Basin, which have very important fossils at Fuente Nueva and Barranco León, are correlations a little less clear than what we've heard about today from East Africa, Dimanisi, China, and Indonesia. And it seems that the dates at 1.3 are quite reasonable, and Bienvenido mentioned material that might be older than that, but one would have to be very careful to see exactly what's involved. There are far too many cases in parts of Europe and elsewhere in the world where small numbers of broken rocks, which may or may not be artifacts, are claimed to be with old dates and that they have not stood up to intense consideration. The older it is, and therefore the more interesting, the more effort one must spend making sure that these are reasonable and accurately dated. I'd also just like to say for a second to Miriam, it's difficult. You can always say, well, maybe it took 500,000 years for such a taxon to evolve. I've done this in the past and been shot at and lost. And I agree completely that one has to be careful about that also. If we accept any kind of punctuated equilibrium model, maybe it took 25,000 years for hippopotamus behemoth to become distinct, and we'll never know. That's all I'm saying. One, data are better than hypotheses to begin with.
Rick?
A point to follow up on Richard's point. Really, I think it's a point that's the opposite side of the same coin, and that is to draw attention to the fact that there is a terrific behavioral record in Africa, that in addition to the dates outside of Africa, that we need a lot more work, at more sites, the behavioral record in East Africa, at least, is especially well known and well studied in the Turkana Basin of northern Kenya and also at Olduvai Gorge in northern Tanzania. And one of the things that can be studied there is the mobility of the hominins. For the stone toolmakers, how long of a distance did they need to travel to get to the raw material sources that are found where the stone tools are made, and in those basins, and in the cut marks on bones indicating butchery activities. And from the time period of going back even further to Hadar and the Middle Awash as well, where the data are also starting to come in, we do not see that the toolmakers were going more than about 10 to 15 kilometers to get the stone raw material that they needed. In the early part of the record, actually, they're only going hundreds of meters to get that stone raw material. That's fine. You can't necessarily take that as an absolute as a way to calculate foraging range. But what you see in both the Olduvai and the Turkana Basin records, where you have a sequence of, you can follow the sequence of change through time, is that it's right after the top of the what's called the Olduvai paleomagnetic event, about 1.77 or 1.78 million years, that the hominin toolmakers begin to break these tethers. They go longer distances to collect raw material. They're also establish archaeological sites in a wider range of depositional context, depositional environments that suggest that they are not just tethered to lake margins or to stream channel environments or very specific magnets of attraction that the hominins prior to 1.78 seem to be tied to. And so it seems to me from that point of view, you have two hypotheses, that if the records of Olduvai and Turkana toolmakers is a reliable, if those records are a reliable guide to hominin mobility, that it's not until about 1.78 million years ago that hominins were breaking the tethers that would have allowed them to look over what's in the next valley. Or the second hypothesis is that those hominins are not representative of the hominins that left Africa. And we don't know the answer necessarily to that, but we need more such studies, I think, of the archaeological record to look at this mobility and these mobility constraints as the other side of the coin to getting the best possible dates outside of Africa.
Excellent. Well, that gives us a lot to talk about in the reception, which we're almost overdue for. So I don't want to keep you any longer, but please join me in thanking our panelists for today.